From WBUR Boston, I'm Gail Harrison. For Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Ibrahim al-Jafari, Iraq's current vice president and Shiite head of the Dawa Party, is closing in on the job of prime minister, but a last-ditch scramble by the man who has the job now could still block the way. Jafari sounds like a moderate, but his Dawa Party is committed to Sharia law in Iraq, and Jafari himself has pushed for it as vice president. The race between Jafari and the current prime minister, Ayed Alawi, highlights two possible paths that lie ahead for the new government and the tension between secular and religious factions in a country clinging to hope. Tonight on Point, Ibrahim al-Jafari, what he would mean for Iraq, the Persian Gulf, and the United States. We begin tonight in Baghdad, where backroom deals reached a feverish pitch with this week's withdrawal of Ahmed Chalabi from the race. One of the leading candidates and one-time Pentagon pick for Iraqi president, Chalabi long ago lost his support from Washington. Jackie Spinner is a correspondent for The Washington Post, and I asked her why Chalabi dropped out.
Chalabi had some very intense pressure within the Shiite bloc to withdraw for the bid. He was getting this pressure from the Islamists, the really sectarian part of the Shiite bloc. He is seen somewhat like Alawi as being a secular Shiite, very close to the U.S. at one point, with ties to Iran. And so that really bothered a lot of the religiously conservative members of the Shiite coalition.
Well, now, what about the current interim prime minister, Ayed Alawi? He says that he's also a candidate, but he only won, or his party only won, 40 seats in parliament. Can he put some kind of coalition together here?
He can. It is quite possible. And I don't think anybody here is ruling out yet that Alawi could keep his job, which, when the election results were announced, most everyone here dismissed him as a serious contender. But he has in recent days picked up some Sunni support. It's not a great deal of support, but it is some support. If he is able to convince the Kurdish political parties that he's the right man for the job, they have 75 seats, and they could string together a potentially significant bloc. And the Shiite bloc, even though they enjoy a slim majority, they're not a unified bloc, as the debate between Chalabi and Jafari proved out over the last couple of days.
Well, now, what about some of those ethnic Kurdish parties? How much of a say are they going to have in what happens here?
Well, they won a significant number of seats in the assembly, 75. That's the second largest block of seats that any political group won. And they're very influential. They're considered to be very secular. But the interesting thing about the Kurds is that while they're absolutely unified or united with the Shiite, I mean, both ethnic groups were oppressed under Saddam Hussein, they're pushing for a federalist government, they're pushing for a secular government, and that puts them against the Shiites, or at least the religiously conservative Shiites to some extent. They've got a lot of power, but they've got to use it very carefully because there's a lot of suspicions among the Sunnis about, you know, whether or not there should be a Kurdish president, and that's the post that they're kind of gaming for.
Exactly. That's the trade-off. You vote for our guy for president, and we'll back your guy for prime minister.
Right. And there was a significant meeting today among the Sunni sheikhs who actually boycotted the election. And one of the things that came out of that meeting today was that they don't want Talabani, Jalal Talabani, who's the head of the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, to be president. They don't think it's appropriate at all for a Kurd to be president of an Arab country, particularly when the Kurds have said post-election that one of their primary goals is to become an independent state.
As you wrote in today's Washington Post, Jafari was something of a surprise front-runner who emerged in recent weeks. Did it help, or perhaps I should say, how much did it help, that he is also the brother-in-law of the Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani?
Well, it certainly helps him in the South. I mean, that's where Sistani's base is, and Sistani is the most revered figure in the Shiite religion here. But it also hurts him to some extent, even though Sistani has made it clear that his support or endorsement of any candidate or if his participation in the election ended at the election, there's some concern among those who want the Iraqi government to be liberal and secular, that having a Sistani-backed candidate will make it much easier for the Shiites to get their will in the Constitution. And anybody here who wants a secular government has great fears about that.
Now, of course, in his news conference yesterday, Jafari said that he was going to reach out to all Iraqis. Is that the sort of thing that any candidate for prime minister would feel obliged to say?
Absolutely. I mean, nobody here is going to become prime minister unless he is able to unify this country. And, you know, Jafari has, as you said, made a point of saying that he's going to reach out to the Sunnis. He's definitely softened his Islamist stance. But whether or not he can convince the population that he is sincere in that is a big question. We talked to many ordinary Iraqis yesterday all over the country, from the Shiite South to the Sunni Triangle, Anbar, Fallujah, and Mosul, which is a very divided city. And we had a hard time finding people who supported Jafari. And I think that's because there is fear that he is a very sectarian candidate and he's going to promote his party and his particular religion.
I want to get back to some of that reaction in just a moment. But first, I also want to ask you about the other big issue here. Obviously, has to be security. Is there any evidence that Jafari could be any better at securing Iraq than the current interim prime minister Alawi has been?
Well, this is a point, actually, that Jafari's on the defensive. He's a very soft-spoken individual. He's not considered to be a strong leader. He's a conciliatory leader. He's very flexible, which could work in his favor in terms of uniting the country. But the Iraqis that we've talked to have, one of the reasons that they support Alawi is because he's considered very tough. He's an ex-Ba'athist whose policy of de-Ba'athification has angered a lot of people, but he is considered very tough on the insurgency. He hasn't been able to beat it, though. And so anybody who could come in and offer a different plan on being able to beat the insurgency would certainly have a lead up on Alawi at this point.
And so let's talk for a moment about some of the reaction that you got from people around Iraq. Not all Shiite Muslims thought that Jafari was the right person to lead the country.
That's correct. If you look at the alliance itself, and this is the 140 members who won seats in this new parliament or national assembly, as they're calling it, in the days leading up to this decision, what we were hearing from party insiders is that Chalabi actually had the majority of the votes. I mean, people really wanted him. And it was the Islamists in the party who see a Shiite majority as a political victory for a people long oppressed in this country that actually got their bid. Alawi put in his nomination several days ago, and the buzz that we were hearing is that was a direct attack on this indecision that had gripped the Shiites. If you put up Chalabi against Alawi, it would be that it's a very different fight than Jafari versus Alawi.
And Jackie, if you will, walk us through what happens next. There's this new 275-member National Assembly. They're going to be meeting, what, within the next couple of weeks, and then what?
Yeah, we expect them to meet within, as you said, the next couple of weeks, certainly by the 1st of March. And they will pick a president and two vice presidents. And that panel, in turn, will pick a prime minister. And once that government is seated, they will establish the cabinet. And all of this has to be done by a two-thirds majority in order to pick the presidential panel. The actual prime minister is a unanimous choice, but all of that is really a technical procedure that's mandated by the interim Iraqi constitution. What we believe will happen is that all this horse trading will end even before the parliament meets, and these decisions are going to be made, these posts are going to be selected, as they would be in the United States, long before there's an actual vote that is taken.
It is an interesting process. I mean, it does seem designed to either force that kind of horse trading, that kind of discussion among a lot of different groups, but maybe that's what democracy is all about.
One of the most fascinating things for those of us who have been here for a while is to watch this process unfold. Not only do you have the politicians taking part in the debate, but you have ordinary Iraqis in the coffee shops, in the universities, on the street, and everybody's engaged in this discussion. Everybody has an opinion. And that was something that was unheard of under Saddam Hussein. First of all, people didn't have a choice. They knew when they went to the polls, there was one man and one party who was going to get elected. Just the fact that people don't know what's going to happen, it's a very exciting thing for many Iraqis.
So as you went up, notebook in hand, and approached people and said, what do you think? I mean, did you get a sense of real exhilaration on their part that they could make that kind of comment in public?
Yeah, I mean, you know, people are willing to give their names, which is, you know, somewhat unusual. They're willing to tell you where they're from, what they do. I mean, identifiable characteristics, you know, that are attached to their opinion. And they believe their opinion counts. I mean, Iraqis have a reputation. I mean, they'll talk about anything at any length except politics, or that had been the case in the past. And, you know, people will, if you ask them, you know, what do you think, who are you going to vote for, or who did you vote for, they'll engage you for 30 minutes telling you exactly what they think is the best choice and exactly why they think that. And that's an extraordinary thing here.
It sounds very much like it. Jackie Spinner, thank you so much.
Sure, it's my pleasure.
Jackie Spinner is a correspondent for The Washington Post. She spoke with me from Baghdad. We're talking this hour about Ebrahim al-Jafari, the frontrunner in Iraq's race for prime minister, and about what his victory might mean to Iraq. We invite you to join the conversation. Are you comfortable with a religious government in Iraq as long as it is elected democratically? And with Iraq poised to select its own prime minister, is America's work closer to being done? American troops closer to coming home? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking about Ebrahim al-Jafari and the Iraq he could help create. Are you concerned about religious rule in Iraq? What do you think that might look like? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now from Vienna, Virginia, is Judith Yaffe, Iraq specialist at the National Defense University. She was a Middle East specialist at the Office of Near Eastern and South Asian Analysis at the CIA from 1975 to 1995. Judith, welcome back.
Thank you.
So what do you make of all of this? We see al-Jafari may have been nominated by his party, but it isn't a sure thing that he'll become prime minister?
With a political system which elects from the country is one district, you are going to have these coalitions. Their system is not unlike Israel's, which always has coalition governments in which Prime Minister Sharon, if he wants to do something in Gaza, will have to move closer to labor rather and away from the right wing of his party. It's a back and forth thing, and Iraq is, in that sense, has the same system of coalition government.
So what are the obstacles for al-Jafari at this point?
Well, he's got several obstacles. He's got to try to form a coalition which will give him the 182 votes he needs to be able to get through whatever legislation they want. And it looks like he's going to come up shy, but nobody knows yet. They are dealing. He may get the Kurds, but the Kurds have their own issues. He may be appealing to the, it seems to be more of a rivalry between him and Ayad Alawi, both of whom want to see where the Kurds will go. And there's a bunch of little minority votes, but they don't amount to more. Probably the best that could happen for Alawi is if the Kurds come in with him, they can play a major spoiler role.
Give us a sense of who he is as a person. What is his backstory? We know that he fled Iraqi
Jafari?
Persecution, yes, in 1980. What else do you know about him?
Well, he's a physician, member of the Dawah Party. He is a very religious Shia Muslim, which means, for example, he will not shake hands with a woman or touch her unless it's a member of his family. We know that he spent about 10 years in exile in Iran, as did many Iraqis. Saddam Hussein repressed the Shia clerics and the more religious, and anyone suspected of being a member of these clandestine parties, which he was. So he had to flee. a great many of them, of course, went just next door to Iran, where there was safe haven and where you could be close to Iraq. He left Iran, though, in the late 1980s, maybe 1990, and joined with the opposition in London. And that would have been the broader-based opposition that was forming against Saddam Hussein. Now, there are a lot of theories about him. Nobody's really sure what he will do. There have been a lot of assumptions made. Well, he's a Shia. He spent a lot of time in Iran. Therefore, that must mean that he's going to create a government in Iran, just like in Iraq, just like they have in Iran, and he's going to be their tool or in their pocket. And there's no reason to make all of these assumptions. These dots don't necessarily connect.
What about the Dawa Party? Or is there cause for concern there?
That's a very good question. The Dawa Party in the 1980s, again, they were clandestine. They also had links to another very nasty group, which was the Hezbollah terrorist organization that was operating in Lebanon and did a lot of terrorism, initially at the behest to help Iran in its war with Iraq. They took hostages. They were involved in at least one of our embassy bombings, the Marine Barracks bombing. That was 1983 and 84. The taking of our hostages in Lebanon, which they always had about a dozen more or less, plus other foreigners. There were hijackings. There were a lot of events. We know that there was a link with Dawa Party members because there were a series of terrorist operations in Kuwait. And one of those was an attempt to assassinate the Emir of Kuwait. The others included bombings at our embassy, at the French embassy, bombings at the Raytheon Corporation. And the Kuwaitis caught a group. They were called the Dawa 17. And of those, 14 were Iraqi members of the Dawa Party. Were they acting for the party or on their own? The other three were Lebanese Shia, one of whom was a brother-in-law of the leader of the Lebanese terrorist organization, whom we have put a price on his head. We want him. And we've never been able to catch him. But he conducted a series of operations to get his brother-in-law out of prison.
Judith, stay with us. I want to bring into the conversation Khaled Abu El Fadl, who is joining us from Los Angeles, California.
Great.
He is professor of Islamic law at the UCLA School of Law and also author of Islam and the Challenge of Democracy. Khaled, welcome to you.
Well, very nice to be with you.
And give us your sense. You've been hearing a bit of the 1980s story of the Dawa Party from Judith Yaffe. What can you tell us about them? How do you view them?
Well, the Dawa Party, they've resembled a matrix of perspectives and points of view, and underwent several mutations through their history. We've got to remember that this is a party that at one time was very focused on opposing Saddam Hussein, and they are also a party that had large numbers of their membership either killed or imprisoned or disappeared and so on.
Is there anything to fear from them now?
My reading of them is more optimistic. Many of them during the persecution of Saddam Hussein fled to Iran or to Kuwait. And in the case of Kuwait, they produced quite a bit of literature about their theological outlook and their sort of their political understanding of what Islam requires of them. One of the main things is that the Dawa Party had tried to rise above sectarian divisions. They've tried to be inclusive of Shia and Sunni. That meant that it was very difficult for them to promote anything like the Wilayat al-Faqih view of government, the government by the jurist councils, as the type of government that exists in Iran. And they had, by the 90s, where writing their literature had become strongly pro-democracy, advocating democracy as the solution to many of the problems that confront Iraq.
So, Judith Yaffe, does that make you feel better? Do you see them as a transformed party?
You asked me about the history, and what I described to you is what members of it were involved in the 1980s. Khaled is absolutely right on what he says about their transformation. I've always thought one of the more interesting aspects was that they were very uncomfortable being a member of the umbrella organization that the Iranians constructed among the exiles, which is the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq.
Right.
They were they would criticize the leadership for being too much a tool of Iran, structured, too organized by them. And they had a different agenda. He's quite right. What will that mean for the future? It's hard to say. I am reminded, though, of several things that when their longtime leader, who was murdered last in August of 2003, Mohammed Bakr Hakim, said, he would always argue that Iraq is not Iran, and it had to be governed on a different basis, and it had to have an inclusive government, and that was all fine. And he talked about democracy. He also, though, believed that in the fullness of time, in the long term, that I think that Iraq would be a less secular, a more religious state. But again, he was murdered. His brother, who's sort of taken over the helm, served in the governing council and in Mr. Alawi's provisional government, but he is not taking a post in this newly elected government, which fits with Sistani's and many Iraqis, frankly, the common view, which is that clerics should not be in the government. It doesn't mean there won't be a religious government or Sharia law. It simply says the part of Iran which says clerics must be there to guide the government. That they do not accept a cleric's role as part of the government.
Khaled, I wonder if you'd give us one or two of the key elements of Sharia. What might we expect if, in fact, this became a government with a strong religious influence or, indeed, governed by Islamic law?
Well, I mean, the problem when we talk about Sharia is that we are talking about an amorphous concept. Sharia includes general ethical principles that one can identify as universal. But it also includes a lot of specific laws, many of which belong to the medieval age or would have not raised an eyebrow in the medieval age, but definitely raise an eyebrow in the modern age. Laws that have to do with stoning of adulterers or severing hands of thieves and so on. Now, I don't think that the current Dawah Party. I mean, Bakr al-Hakim was a very different mind than Jafari. I cannot imagine, for a variety of reasons, and I don't believe that Jafari's understanding of Sharia or the integration of Sharia in society as requiring him to apply ahistorical laws or the specific laws that would create an enormous amount of division, an enormous amount of dissent, not just by secular Iraqis, but by reformed, more liberal Muslims, more reformed Muslims, more modernist Muslims. And he would also steer away from doctrines that would alienate Sunni Muslims.
Khaled, I want to stop you just for a second because we have a caller I want to bring into the conversation. John's on the line from Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, John. What did you want to tell us?
Hi. I just wanted to make a point that over here in the U.S., we have President Bush who lets his Christian views dominate just so much of his policies and politics. And so how can we sit over here and say that the United States should dictate, you know, that Iraq should have a purely secular government?
So religious leadership is nothing to be alarmed about, John?
Well, I think it is, but I think we have a situation over here where, you know, at least over in Iraq, they're saying what they're going to do with their religious government. Here we have somebody who is elected, and he's just letting his Christian views and, you know, like the Christian right is fully involved in so many aspects of our government, from judicial to legislative. They're involved in science.
Got it, John.
Trade and everything else.
All right. Thank you so much for the call. I'm Gail Harris, and this is On Point. Judith, let me put that question to you. How would you answer, John?
Well, I think the problem is, we don't know what Jafari will do. We do know that when he was on the governing councils earlier, he did want to implement stricter religious laws. For example, laws that affect women. In Iraq, women have always had a tradition of being more independent, of being able to get education, of serving in government. And Jafari seems to come from the point of view that women really are, you know, part of, controlled by the men who make the decisions in the family, that would, things that might restrict their freedom, Islamic law, which restricts the inheritance, it's not equal. In other words, things that might restrict their ability to go around. I'm not saying he would insist that every woman be covered with hijab and chador, but Iraqis are concerned about that. Now, I think the question we have to ask ourselves, and I don't want to get back to what the caller was talking about in terms of here, that was a very interesting observation, but can we expect Iraq, which is 95% Muslim, to be less Muslim or less Islamic than, for example, secular Republican Egypt, which does not exactly have democratic institutions or real elections? But in Egypt, the way that they have co-opted the Islamist opposition is by allowing clerics to, in effect, have a say. They've co-opted a lot of the religious platform or programs that the religious groups have argued for, and clerics can have a say over lawmaking. In other words, they can judge whether a law is in conformance with Quran and the tradition or not. Now, that gives them quite a bit of say in lawmaking and in governance. The question then becomes, can we expect Iraq to really be any less Muslim than Egypt is?
Khaled, I'd like to hear from you on that in about the minute or so we have before we need to take a break.
Well, listen, the situation in Egypt is very different than Iraq because the role played by the clergy in Egypt is in fact dictated by the reality that Egypt is a dictatorship. In other words, the government allows the clergy to play this authoritarian role because the government needs legitimacy and it lacks it because it's a despotic government. Iraq is a country that is extremely diverse ethnically as well as intellectually, has a long tradition of secularism, and the most important point that I want to make is that in the West we hear the word Sharia and we have a knee-jerk reaction of this will mean such and such law. It will mean oppressive laws. It will mean unfair laws. It will mean medieval-sounding laws. In reality, let's remember the Islamic Party that took power in Turkey.
I have to ask you to hold it there, and we'll resume with that thought right after we take a break, Khalid. We're talking this hour about Ibrahim al-Jafari and Iraq's struggle between secular and religious rule. Are you concerned that the possible pick for prime minister heads a party that has long advocated religious government in Iraq? Or is he the right man for the times? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Gail Harris, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about Ibrahim al-Jafari, who is leading the pack in the race for prime minister, and about the debate over a secular or religious government in Iraq. Would a religious government in Iraq still be a win for the United States? Would it help stabilize the country or turn it into another Iran? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking this hour with Judith Yaffe, former CIA analyst and Iraq specialist at the National Defense University, and with Khaled Abu al-Fadl, professor of Islamic law at UCLA Law School and also author of Islam and the Challenge of Democracy. And Khaled, I had to cut you off earlier. I want to give you a chance to finish that thought, which seemed to be heading in the direction of perhaps Westerners recoil from the idea of Sharia. Why? Because we don't know enough about it?
Well, yes. I mean, and I don't exactly blame Westerners for that, because the example set by Saudi Arabia and Iran and examples that we've seen in Nigeria have instilled a certain view of Sharia in the minds of people that don't know how vast and amorphous and rich this tradition is. I think the litmus test is often for me is whether a particular politician is going to advocate that women be forced to wear the veil. And Jafari has, to my knowledge, never made that type of statement and never held that type of view of Islamic law, where women would be forced to veil, or where he's adopted a Saudi version of Islamic law, which basically relegate women to subhuman status. I think Jafari will be much more like the Turkish version of an Islamic party in power, and all indications in terms of his own statements and in terms of his own writings seem to be to point to that direction.
To our phone lines again, to Lexington, Massachusetts this time. Peter is on the line. Hello, Peter, and welcome.
Hello. I think that the United States made a great error in putting the cart before the horse, that is, in attempting to bring democracy and thinking this was some kind of solution before trying to get someone in power who would, like Kemal Ataturk, de-Islamize, or rather put constraints on Islam. And I think that Alawi was the person who might have done it. What may happen now is that all of this money, $300 billion and rising, will put in place a regime that is more, not less, Islamic. And I think that this is a colossal misallocation of resources at this point. Had they come in, set up Alawi, said, okay, you're here for, 5 years or whatever, we're leaving, although we will withdraw to the desert and, be there to support you. And I think Alawi could have stayed in power and prevented this, what I think is going to be a disaster. As far as the Sharia goes, I think that al-Fadl is not quite, he's setting the bar awfully low in talking about his test is whether women have to wear the full burqa or whatever, I would say, are people allowed to apostatize without being harmed? That would be my test.
Peter, thanks so much for the call. Judith, what about that? Should the United States have given Alawi a little more support? On the other hand, he only got 40 seats in Parliament. That sounds like a,
If we had done what the caller is asking, that would not have been democratic. If we had set up somebody in power and said, okay, go and do, we would have had to be behind him every minute and for quite a long time. I'm not sure that's what the caller wanted. Iraq has to make its own choices. It is true that many Iraqis value the strong determination and ability to make decisions that Alawi represents. He's certainly a vast improvement over what was first set up by us when we got there, which was the Governing Council. And all they did was avoid decision-making, avoid responsibility while they looked to benefit their own, self-promotion. That's not Alawi, but we have to set up a system where the Iraqis choose. We can't choose for them. I think that what I hear on so far this evening, and in effect you're doing it, is to set up the kind of situation that Khaled and I are arguing against. We don't know what he will do, what Jafari will do. He may say that this is his private religion and he will follow his private ways and that he wants to have an inclusive Iraq. Will Iraqis believe him? I think it's much more important that they are negotiating instead of shooting each other, that they are trying to work out some way that they can resolve a lot of these tensions. And you've got a more serious problem in terms of how the negotiations go with the Kurds, who insist on a president and many other things. And the Sunnis are saying that's we just can't take that. Everyone's got their agenda. The Kurds have an awful lot on their plate that they're demanding because they're in a position to swing this either way. Now, how they work that out is very critical. And so that whatever may be meant by an observant Jafari, by Sharia, I think we may be wasting too much time obsessing about that when it won't turn out to be the real problem. It may be that Iraq will fall back on the tradition that goes back to Ottoman governance, goes back a long time in Islamic history, which is that personal status law is religious law, is the law that governs the communities, whether you are Sunni or Shia or Christian. There were Jews in Iraq for a long time, but you were guided by the personal status law of your faith and creed. Now, would we have an objection to that? Not if that's what the Iraqis choose.
Yes, please do, Helen. Indeed, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I've just got to object very strongly to what that caller just said. I mean, I can't describe sufficiently how offensive, as a Muslim, how offensive what this caller said is to me. Because what he just said is that we needed to put someone to cure Muslims of their Islam before we can, in fact, let Iraq rule itself. Well, colonial powers have, in fact, done that. They've installed secular rulers that have been allied to Western interests and that have been staunchly secular and anti-Islamic. And what is the result? The result was extreme anti-Westernism, the belief that the West fundamentally hates the religion of Islam and the creation of more fanaticism and extremism.
Well, Khaled, is there actually a danger then of Jafari being too secular?
I don't think so. I mean, it is very telling that Jafari is not anti-Western, and despite the fact that he is not by any measure, anti-Western. He was supported by a large number of people, and the idea that Islam is an illness that needs to be cured before Muslim people should be allowed to rule themselves is so paternalistic and so arrogant. That it is exactly what creates the type of extremism, fanaticism, and terrorism that is generated in the Middle East. And it's time that we learn to respect Muslim people and respect their faith rather than expect them to be a mirror image of us.
Judith, I hear you agreeing, and I also want to ask you about...
I do agree with him. I think the caller was way out of line. And I think you have to ask yourself what is in the Iraqis' best interest and in our own. Before the election, Jafari, like Alawi, like many of the other candidates running, all said, we will not demand that the U.S. withdraw immediately. We're not going to ask for a timeline. They said a lot of things that show that they're concerned about stability and security there. It won't get better than that for us. But if the kind of sentiments that the caller raised become more, people become more seized with that, that's bad. That would be very bad for us.
We want to quickly take one more phone call from Concord, Massachusetts. Jala is on the line. Hello.
Hi. Yes, I was just going to say that the reason I believe that the United States is failing in Iraq is reflected by the arrogance of the callers to your program. None of them realize that the majority of Iraqis risk their lives to go and vote for what they wanted. Everybody's calling of what we should have done. And they don't realize that United States actually did everything in their power to do what to prevent an Islamic rule. They tried to install Chalabi, they tried to install Alabi, they tried to, do all these things. It all failed. It all failed.
Jala, we hear you. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We have to go. Thank you so much for calling. And Judith, can I ask you just for a succinct summary of what Americans should be looking for to happen next? What are the warning signs? What are the signs of progress?
Warning signs that the Kurds get unhappy or they see weakness in Baghdad and they decide to move on their agenda, which could bring all the Arabs together. In other words, if they try to move and seize more territory like Kirkuk, that could ignite a lot of opposition. We're not going to solve the insurgencies in the short term. That's going to continue. But if at the center in Baghdad where they're trying to form a political system, if that works, then that's very encouraging because that will lead to the Iraqis being able to assume the kind of control for their security, which could free up our forces. But that's not going to happen in the short term.
Judith Yaffe, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Iraq specialist at the National Defense University in Washington, D.C. Khaled Abu al-Fadl, thank you so much.
You're quite welcome.
Professor of Islamic Law at the UCLA School of Law and also the author of Islam and the Challenge of Democracy. You can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. This is On Point. After 3.5 years, the New York City Medical Examiner's Office announced today that it has ended the process of identifying victims of the 9/11 terrorist attack on the World Trade Center. The remains of nearly half of the more than 2,700 victims remain unidentified. This marks the end of the painful waiting process for family members of the victims, many of whom were holding on to hope that scientists would be able to identify some part of their lost loved ones. The thousands of remains that scientists have been unable to identify will eventually be placed in a memorial at the site of the World Trade Center. Robert Shaler is director of forensic biology at New York's Medical Examiner's Office. In this radio diary, he explains why the identification process has been suspended.
I guess the simple answer is that we ran out of remains that still could be tested using the technology we have. The complicated answer is that the remaining DNA inside the remains is so degraded that it doesn't give results using the technologies we've been using. The significance is that the families can pick up the remains and now they can move on. The chances that they're going to have anything new is very, very remote. With that said, however, we are pursuing new technologies. I mean, we have some remains that have some DNA left in them. The DNA left there is not good enough for us to make an identification, but maybe someday there'll be new technologies years down the road that maybe somebody else can analyze them. We also have remains that have no biological material in, and therefore they will never, ever tell us who they came from. So this is the kind of situation we're in. We're in a kind of a pause mode, and we're looking for new technologies and new ways to analyze the data that we have so that we might be able to get some new identifications in the future. They want to bring the family home. They want the family together. It just rings through the whole of this whole process has been the need for the family to be together, to be whole, and to bring your loved one home has been extremely important to them. And I think that's part of the reason why the families have been so supportive of us, because we have put our heart and soul into trying to do that for them, given the best technologies we could devise and the best scientific procedures that we could put together to do it for them. They thank us for the work that we've done, and they understand that now that it's for them that it's over, and they can have their final memorials and kind of put it behind them and move on. And I think that this is something they've been waiting to do and wanting to do. We've had a number of people working on this since September 11th, 2001. And as you can well imagine, they've done nothing else, and they're pretty much emotionally drained. To their credit, they would never, ever have let me take them off the project because they just felt that they were obsessed with it. They just had to get it done, and they were going to see it to its logical endpoint, which is where we are now. So this gives them a chance to sort of rebuild their lives and move on to doing other things in their lives, catching up with the rest of the world, if you will. And this is the same for me.
Robert Shaler is director of forensic biology at the New York City Medical Examiner's Office. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Rachel Dornhelm, Eileen Amata, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Tim Skog, Michael Garth, and Angel Coselli. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.